KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. What are you? And I mean in terms of religion or a belief in God. What are you? Which usually means, are you an atheist or are you a believer? The journalist Leslie Hazelton is tired of those labels because she says they don't really tell us very much, and most people resist fitting into one of those categories in the first place. Hazelton herself is agnostic, and her new book is an exploration of her perspective. It's a manifesto, but it doesn't make a claim to truth or to certainty. Faith and belief and mystery and meaning, none of that, Hazelton says, is black and white. It's more textured. And it's not a thing you solve, but what she calls in her book, an open-minded adventure of the mind. Hazelton will join us. We hope you will too, after the news.
Hey, podcast listener. I'm Benjamin Bombard. I'm one of the producers of Radio West. If you like what you hear on the show, you can lend a hand by giving us a review on iTunes or Stitcher or Facebook. And we'd also really appreciate it if you'd share what you think about the show, or if you have some thoughts about a particular episode, share that stuff around on whatever social media platforms you happen to use. Thanks a bunch and enjoy the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the writer and psychologist Leslie Hazelton. We're talking about her new book, which is an agnostic manifesto. Hazelton is an agnostic, pretty much always has been, even though she was the only Jew in an English convent school growing up. She didn't necessarily walk away from either of those faiths. She's completely secular, we should say, but she says in the book the cultural and historical weight of religion has bared her down. She finds beauty, for example, in chants and in the tolling of bells. But her manifesto doesn't stake a claim on truth, and she isn't out to convert anyone to this way of thinking. What she is trying to do is write about the simple honesty in saying that you don't know, or to acknowledge, as she says in her book, the unknowable and yet explore it at the same time. Her book is Agnostic, a Spirited Manifesto, and we invite you to join the conversation if you like. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Leslie Hazelton is a former journalist who reported from Jerusalem for 13 years. Her work has appeared in the New York Times and Harper's and other publications. She was on the program not so long ago talking about her biography of Muhammad called The First Muslim. And she's also written about the Sunni-Shia split. And she's joining us today from NPR member station KUOW in Seattle, Washington. Leslie Hazelton, welcome back. Thanks for being with us again.
Thank you for having me, Doug.
So let's begin with the mezuzah, which is at the entrance of your home, which happens to be a houseboat. I guess it still is. Is that right? Still on the houseboat?
Yeah, it's kind of it's a shack on a raft, floating on a lake about a mile north of downtown Seattle.
And there's a mezuzah at the entrance there. And as there I is. Pointed out, you're Jewish but completely secular, and don't really believe a word of the prayer contained in the mezuzah, the Shema, but. Yeah. And in fact, you say you hardly notice it's there anymore, but it matters to you in some way. Let's start there. Why does that mezuzah matter in some way?
It's a paradox, isn't it? A wonderful conundrum. And the wonderful thing about conundrums is that they are not solvable, right? I don't have an answer. I don't have answers at all, in fact, just questions and explorations. So why is it there? It's a matter of identity. It's a matter of loyalty to, you know, who I was born to and so on. It's a matter of, it just wouldn't feel right if I didn't have it there. And in fact, it doesn't have the prayer in it, partly because it kept falling out, right? when I tried to put it up on the door. Yeah. And also because, as you say, I really don't believe a word it says anyway. And I have no idea where that little prayer is. But just the symbol of it there is important to me. It's symbolic somehow of something that goes very deep, which goes way beyond. It has nothing to do with belief or even with faith. It goes way beyond that to questions of who I am and the terms on which I exist in this world. Which I think are really the issues that, you know, these are the issues that religion once claimed to address and then sort of got bogged down by dogma and so on and actually fails too often to address. And this is what I'm trying to get to. I'm trying to basically reclaim all these once religious questions from religion and just, you know, put them out there as questions of our existence in this world and how we are in the world and with the world.
But it is so hard. This is something I noticed reading the book. It's so difficult, and we'll sort of work around this, because there seem to be some biological explanations and psychological explanations, but we have a hard time with uncertainty as a species, it seems, don't we?
Oh, we do. We love certainty. We love the illusion that we know, the illusion of being absolutely sure of something. I mean, it's there in all the polls, you know, because all the polls ask, do you believe or do you not believe, right? And they don't leave any room for anything but, you know, if you say, well, I'm not quite sure, then they'll say, well, which way do you lean, right? And they kind of force you to lean one way or the other, right, towards belief or towards unbelief. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the whole point, you know, so that they can then report their findings and come up with, you know, impressive statistics and
right.
so on.
Right.
But the thing is that, you know, that leaves no room to stand up straight. Right. And I stand very tall as an agnostic. Mm-hmm. I completely reject that sort of flat line between belief and unbelief, and this assumption that as an agnostic I have to be somewhere in between, or else I'm, you know, as atheists tend to say, I'm sort of sitting on the fence, you know, mm-hmm. sort of scared to go one way or the other. And I'm just looking at that line and saying, I'm not interested in this. I'm going to leave that where it belongs, which is on the ground. And I'm just going to take off, right, into thinking about basically taking off into territory that I know is unknowable and that I want to explore nonetheless.
Yeah. Yeah.
Intangibles such as consciousness and infinity and whatever it is we might conceive of when we use what's basically the metaphysical shorthand of the word God.
It's interesting. I guess you can't really pinpoint a time when you became agnostic. Does someone do that? Do they just all of a sudden come to a conclusion, I'm not sure I believe, but I don't really know. I mean, you said you've been agnostic for almost as long as you can remember, but can you pinpoint a moment when you started to really think about it, or do you just sort of settle into it?
It's just a label. Yeah. It's just a label, right? If I could take the ism out of agnosticism, I would, because you know the last thing we need is yet another sort of pompously complete system of thought, you know, that demands adherence to some kind of party line. It's a stance. Mm-hmm. I call it the agnostic stance, and it's a stance of inquiry and curiosity, as I say, a way of being in the world, which takes nothing for granted, and there is. In everything to do with faith, belief, meaning, mystery, existence, there is this huge mass of things taken for granted. I mean, when I was making the notes for this book, there's so many that I began to I began to call them TTFGs for short, things taken for granted.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to get beyond those. I want to explore. This is really what thought is. It's exploration. And not with the aim of getting somewhere, not with the aim of making up my mind, right? Which is a very strange phrase, by the way. Make up your mind. Do you believe or do you not believe? It sort of makes me think of an army cot in barracks with everything sort of neatly squared away and all the edges, you know, the corners tucked in. And it's everything so tight that you can't even get into it, let alone sleep in it, basically. I don't want to be like that.
Yeah. When did it bug you so much, though, that you figured, I need to write something about it? I mean, you have been writing about it, we should say. I mean, you write blog entries and those kinds of things. But when did you figure, all right, I need to get this down in a book?
Well, the blog is called The Accidental Theologist, and I gave it the subtitle, An Agnostic Eye on Politics, Religion, and Existence. And what I found was that people kept asking me, but you keep on writing about religion. You know, the biography of Muhammad, there was an earlier biography of Mary and so on. In fact, you know, there's been several books to do with religion and history and the Middle East and so on. And they kept on saying, well, how can you be this interested, you know, in religion and politics if you're not religious? What do you mean by being agnostic? And I'm just saying, you know, here's this huge, fascinating field, which is so human, so full of illogic, but goes so deep and is so emotional that, my God, how can you not be fascinated by it? But basically, it was my readers who kind of, you know, sort of I wouldn't say forced me, but really demanded that I try and define okay, let's not go to definition, but that I try and expand on what I meant by being agnostic. Yeah. And this book is it. I mean, you know, it is, as I say, getting beyond that miserably flat line of belief, unbelief. Because, you know, you've got all these magnificent and ultimately unanswerable questions of meaning and existence. So to reduce them to a mere yes or no, you know, believe or unbelief, for or against, Trump, no Trump, it's absurd. You know, all we're doing is making ourselves and all these great questions very small.
What do you mean when you say that what has been missing so far in this discussion is a strong, sophisticated agnosticism? Are you just saying that there hasn't really been anyone willing, or not very many people anyway, willing to stand up, like you say, and just express?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, it's very easy to accept, you know, or to feel kind of cowed by the accusations of not all atheists, but certainly certain dogmatic atheists. I'm thinking in particular of the four horsemen of the atheist apocalypse,
yeah.
Right? Whom I think of as H2D2. Let me see if I can do it. H2D2 is Harris, Hitchens, Dawkins, and Dennett, right? Who sort of taunt agnostics as, quote unquote, lacking the courage of their convictions, which I think is a fascinating phrase. It only makes me sort of ask what exactly conviction has to do with courage. Because if anything, I think of conviction as a lack of courage, a lack of the courage to explore, the courage to really think. You sort of dash for one end or the other of a totally artificially created spectrum and you sit down there comfortably like a kind of intellectual couch potato and you say, okay, here's where I belong. Here's where I am. I don't need to think any further. What a shame. What a way, as I say, of making our minds small.
Here is a comment from Ryan, who writes from Ogden, Utah. He says, I am a 100% firm atheist. I don't dispute there are some phenomena that we do not understand yet and may never, but I'm confident our universe and everything in it was not created by anyone or anything. Okay, take just that comment, because it seems like the whole book is about Ryan's comment on some level. What do you make of what you're hearing from Ryan? 100% firm atheist, confident our universe was not created by anyone or anything. What do you hear in that?
What I hear is, I'm sorry, Ryan, but what I hear is a kind of reduction of these very large questions to one very simplistic one, which is, does he or doesn't he exist, right? And of course, it's always he, God, right?
Right. We'll get back to that, by the way. I think that's fascinating. Keep going.
I say this is really, it's a metaphysical shorthand, but it's a very, very deceptive one because it's kind of a nickname, really. It's a way of sort of bringing God down, whatever it is we might think of when we use the word God. And I totally agree with Ryan. It's usually far too literal. It's some kind of entity, a thing, a person almost, right? With human attributes, right? With lungs and feet and a really bad temper. And and sometimes very punitive, like a petty tyrant, right? You know, if you don't believe, you're going to go to hell and all kinds of terrible things, plagues and so on are going to come down on you, or a lightning bolt will come and strike you out of the blue. What a petty way to think of whatever it is we think of when we use the word God. As I say, it's just a nickname, and it's but it makes the whole matter very small. Creation of the universe. Well, my question then is, which universe? When we talk about, you know, we're up here against the definite article, right? The truth, always very, the soul, assuming that it's a thing, right? So the meaning of life, like there's only one, right? The universe, when what we really mean and what astrophysicists now talk about is the observable universe. That is, the universe as observed by us, which we now know is only one of billions of universes out there, and for all we know, an infinite number of universes out there.
Yeah.
So, you know, this question of, it's so tempting always to see ourselves as, well, of course we see ourselves at the center of things because, you know, we are the center. It's us who's doing the observing. It's us who's looking out. But I find it very freeing to to step outside that self-involvement and see yourself in a much larger context, to think larger and to live larger than that.
You know, looking at Ryan's comment, this is sort of something you write that atheists seem to share in this popular desire for a tangible God, too. Here's what you write. You say they insist that there has to be some purpose in having a God, even as they deny there is a God.
Right. God is a possession. Belief is a possession. I mean, you could call it the capitalist approach to belief, right? Mm-hmm. Or a matter of spiritual haves and have-nots. What's the God is useful. It's actually an approach from atheists that's very, very similar to that of pious fundamentalists who, you know, will pray to God for something, for success in an exam, or for, you know, healing, or for, in other words, a practical God, right?
Yeah. And very literal
very literal. It's sort of very similar to the way, you know, ancient Greeks used to pray to a pagan god for, you know, specific help in something or other. The whole point of this whole concept of God is by definition, beyond human comprehension. Which doesn't stop humans all the time trying to comprehend it, but even as they do, all we manage to do is bring it down to human size.
I want to get to that when we come back from a break. The idea of corralling the sense of the divine and making it human is an important part of the story. Before we take a break, though, I wanted to have you give us a sense of where you think agnostics fit in the scheme of things. As you said, it's hard to measure things in surveys because they don't really seem to ask a question that would get at whether or not someone might be agnostic. Yeah. Any sense of where people are? I mean, you know, Americans don't like labels. On the other hand, seem to believe in something.
Oh, on the contrary, I think Americans love labels, love categories. How do you think PowerPoint became so successful?
Right.
Hey, you got to fit into one category or the other, right? That's the wonderful thing about agnostics. We defy categories. Do not try and categorize me. Do not try and label me. I stand tall with integrity. When I say strong, sophisticated, agnostic stance. Am I saying I'm strong and sophisticated? Well, not necessarily, but more sophisticated and stronger than this kind of wishy-washy, I don't know-ness, this sort of helpless shrug that many people seem to think agnosticism is. There's nothing of the helpless shrug about it. It's, or there needn't be. It really is a stand of great intellectual integrity and honesty, and one I think that that is very exciting because there's no certainty, because it keeps us on our toes, because it holds on to that sense of wonder and of mystery and of just sheer amazement at the fact that we're here in this world at all. It's great.
Leslie Hazelton is with us. Her book is Agnostic, A Spirited Manifesto, and we'll take a quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the writer Leslie Hazelton is with us, making the case for why she's a proud agnostic. You've heard Hazelton on this program before. She has covered religion as a journalist. And one of the things she learned covering that subject is that it's usually an argument between believers and non-believers. And it bothers her because Hazelton doesn't think that explains where most people are in what they believe or what they don't believe. Agnostics are sometimes seen as fence sitters. But Hazelton revels in her agnosticism. Her book is Agnostic, A Spirited Manifesto. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. I wanted to come back to this idea that you had talked about, that this impulse, I guess it is, or this inclination that we humans have to take such a massive grand idea as God And you even have a problem with us giving it those three, at least in English, those three, you know, that three-letter word.
Uh-huh.
We try to bring it down to human size. You know, we give it a personal pronoun. Generally, it's a he. Mm. What is it about that idea of trying to humanize such a grand, abstruse, abstract concept as God? What is it about that, do you think?
Well, I think it's very human, this desire to make something tangible, to make it concrete, to be able to touch it, to speak to it, to implore it, and so on and so on. And it's, you know, it's difficult, or it's more difficult, I think, to live with possibility than with certainty, right? And yet possibility is where we live, possibilities and probabilities, which is why I love, you know, let's talk about doubt, right? Because, you know, in a sense, agnostics are doubters. Mm-hmm. And yet I trust doubt. You know, you could almost say that I believe in doubt, because I find it very hard to trust anyone who never experiences it.
Mm-hmm.
I'd even say it's impossible for me to trust anyone who never experiences it. And yet, you know, doubt has a terrible reputation. People seem to be afraid of it. It makes them very anxious. And you know, doubt's a kind of a no-go in religion. I blame this personally on St. Augustine. I do realize there's a lot of people I could blame this on, but I choose him. I choose him because of how he described his moment of conversion. And this was what he said. There was infused in my heart the light of full certainty, and all the gloom of doubt vanished away.
Yeah.
And there it is. You know, doubt is a dark cloud looming over us, and certainty is like being lit up in bright lights. You know, I love that phrase, lit up. And, you know, it's the old phrase for being drunk, by the way.
Right. You put Augustine though up against other religious figures who are certain again, and there's a kind of irony here because so many religious figures did experience doubt. Muhammad, for example. Would you talk about that? Because I think this gets us to this idea of how doubt can fit. Nothing restful about real faith, you say. I mean, maybe we're misinterpreting what faith
right.
and belief
we're
should
confused.
Be about. Yeah.
Exactly. We are conflating belief with faith. Belief doesn't actually require faith. Belief, you're sure that you know, right? You're convinced. You're just sitting there comfortably. You've got nowhere to go. Faith is hard. Faith involves the awareness that you may be totally wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But you take that step nonetheless, right? You place your belief in, which means basically you place your trust in something that you know may not come through. That takes courage. That takes real faith. And, you know, Kierkegaard called it the leap to faith. And it
right.
is a leap. It's a logical leap. It's wonderful. Muhammad on the mountain, when he received the first revelation of the Quran, I was amazed when I read that in the earliest Islamic histories. Because, you know, what you think would have happened didn't happen. He didn't say, oh, my God, hallelujah, this is wonderful, and sort of came running down the mountain full of faith and belief and, yeah, I've got all the answers, you know, with the Ten Commandments or whatever. No, he was convinced. And this is there in the earliest Islamic histories, I say. He was convinced that he was crazy.
Yeah.
That he was losing his mind, that this couldn't possibly be happening. And in fact, his first reaction was such shame, such confusion, that he decided to make his way up to the very top of the mountain and throw himself off and kill himself, you know, and put an end to all this by putting an end to his life. So when he came down the mountain with that first revelation of the Quran, he wasn't in a state of ecstasy. He was in a state of fear and trembling. I mean, he was running for his life, as it were. And that part, you know, his wife, Khadija, his first wife, the one to whom he was monogamously married for 24 years until she died, she was the one who held him and comforted him and told him, you know, you may well be the messenger of God. But I love, that's what made him human for me, that doubt. Without that doubt, it was just to be, okay, another revelation story, another sort of classic legend and so on. But with the doubt, my God, this man is human. This is interesting. There's a real person here. Which is why I say I find it incredibly hard to trust anyone who never doubts. There's something very inhuman about that, about absolute certainty, absolute conviction. You can see it in the eyes of fundamentalists, right? You see it in the executioners of ISIS. You see it in it's terrifying because it's not human. It's inhuman.
It's so interesting, too, you write about how when we hold belief, it has this tendency to, you describe it as fossilize into conviction. Mm-hmm. And you say that my belief can then be so adamantly held that it becomes central to my identity. And that's one thing. But then what happens when you no longer believe or you start to doubt? That starts to not only undermine the truth of the thing, but undermine you. So when you hold it so tightly to yourself, when you start to doubt, it messes with your sense of identity.
Yes, when your identity is so bound up in believing. It's and you feel kind of lost. You know, there's that phrase, lost soul, and so on. And we're terrified of being lost. I mean, even more so in this age of GPS and so on, where you don't even have to think about where you're going. You know, you go from A to B, and it's all neatly laid out for you and so on. It's like we've forgotten the adventure of being lost. We've forgotten the excitement of it. Obviously, I'm GPS resistant, right? I think of being lost as an essential part of any good adventure because it makes me pay attention. It makes me look closer. It makes me more aware of where I am. I'm thinking about where I am instead of where I'm going because, of course, where I'm going is where I am not. So this fear of being lost is grounded in the negative, right? You lose your way or you lose your bearings, you lose your balance or your temper, or you lose your patience, you lose your mind. Think what happens when you lose your keys, okay? We've all lost our keys, right? And then we look for them. Of course we look for them. So we search here, we search there, we search high and low. But what do we actually see while we're searching? We only see one thing, and that's not keys, right? We don't see what's there. We only see what's not there. Absence instead of presence. And I want to see what's there, and I want to see as much of it as I can, which doesn't mean, I mean, I'm not saying here that we need to tolerate uncertainty, because, you know, that word tolerate, you really only need to tolerate something you'd rather didn't exist in the first place. Mm-hmm. I want to embrace it. I want to dance with it, because, you know, Voltaire, for instance, right, the great atheist, said, you know, doubt is not a pleasant condition, but certainty is an absurd one. Well, I agree with the second part of that. Certainty is an absurd position. But doubt, I enjoy doubt. Of course it can be pleasant. It's exciting. It's the sign of a mind alive and working. And it's the engine of inquiry. I mean, ask any good scientist, like Richard Feynman, who won the Nobel Prize in physics, who said, "I'd far rather have questions without answers than answers that can't be questioned." Yay, Richard Feynman, right? And then, it's wonderful. He saw doubt as the essence of understanding. And it's what pushes you further. You know, the more answers you get, the more questions arise out of every single answer. This is the engine of science. So what I'm advocating here is not at all unscientific. As any good scientist, you know, bad scientists will think that they have the answers. Good scientists will know that they only have temporary answers, and that every answer leads to an infinity of other questions.
Mm. Here's a comment.
And that's exciting.
Yeah,
to me, it's exciting. To some people, I guess it's depressing.
Or scary. Like you said before, that idea of uncertainty is nothing short of a nightmare for some. Let me read a comment from Gordon. Gordon writes from Park City, writes, "I've essentially been an atheist for the past two decades. It's not that I'm resistant to the idea of a God. I just haven't encountered a convincing argument that one exists. But now in my mid-30s, he writes, I feel a rather despairing lack of belief, and I blame that on secular humanism. Gordon writes, I've recently been trying to cultivate some kind of pagan, animist, earth-based spirituality, and even then, I can't seem to fit a God in there. What do you make of that? What's the value, he says, I think this is what it sort of gets down to. He says, what's the value of spirituality without, you know, without a God?
Ah, That's very interesting. Very interesting phrase that way, Gordon. Thank you. But, you know, a God, God, it's, again, it's sort of trying to, we're trying to define something that cannot be defined. That sense you feel when you're on top of a mountain at sunset or at sunrise, that sense you feel, I mean, but, you know, the biggest, no, the most common, oh God, moment of all, of course, is orgasm. That sense of being without boundaries, of being completely at one as the, and you know, that's the term the mystics used to use for union with God, at one, you know, with the world. This sense of being both infinitesimally small and infinitely large at the same time. This is mystical experience. Spiritual, okay, I avoid using the word spiritual, right, because it tends to be too self-congratulatory somehow, you know, but it's, you know, to see how spiritual I am. But I love the word spirited, right? If we can come at this with spirit, appetite, with zest, instead of sort of, you know, this dismissive derision of the rather more dogmatic atheists, or with the sort of solemn piety of bowed head and sort of timid steps of many, believers. You know, what's missing from all this is just sheer enjoyment of life. This sheer appreciation of the mysterious fact that we're here and that we are human and that we don't make sense and that we're fallible and contradictory and full of conundrums and paradoxes. And I guess what I'm advocating is that we enjoy them instead of trying to solve them. Not everything is there to be solved.
It's so interesting looking at the comments that are coming in, that this idea that you have to make a stand, or that you have to consider evidence and that evidence would come into play. Here's one from Tyler, for example. Tyler says, he said, I've always labeled myself as an atheist because I don't believe in God, especially a personal God, but I don't claim to know that a God doesn't exist. I'd be willing to change my mind if evidence came to light. Uh-huh. Am I an agnostic?
Yeah, probably. I mean, you know, this question of existence, Tyler, it's, you know, it assumes that there's some thing, some entity there that has physical existence. Right.
That's at the heart of his question, right? Is he believes that,
Is this assumption there that
and you say that's the outmoded way of thinking about that. We've got to get away from that kind of thinking.
Well, really, I would love to. I wish it was outmoded.
But you see it as outmoded. You wish it were.
Well, for me, it's definitely outmoded. For me, it never worked in any case. I've lost my train of thought.
I'm sorry. There's so much to be distracted by in these comments. here's something from William. William writes, there's wonder and amazement for the atheist who opens up the exploration of science. The problem with agnosticism, he writes, is defining what you're agnostic about. I think most agnostics really try to maintain a possibility of belief in the gaps, similar to religious people who look for God in the gaps of scientific knowledge. For what it's worth, the multiverse hypothesis is not confirmed by evidence, and it may not be testable. Embracing a concept that cannot be falsified isn't science. It's hopeful grasping. It seems like in some ways you're on the same page with William in most of this.
Oh, yeah. It's like that quote from, oh, God, where is it from? Somewhere in the New Testament. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things unseen.
St. Paul, I think, that. Right?
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah. Can't quite believe I'm quoting St. Paul on the air, but never mind. but there's something there. It's beyond evidence. It's beyond that kind of rather dull, let's stick to the facts, man. Right? Just the facts and nothing else, right? Talking of man, by the way, where are the women here? We've had four guys in a row.
No kidding. They're all men. Bernie, Jim, they're on the phone. We've heard from, here's Glade. Come on, okay, women. Let me read from Glade. Glade says, I find the question of whether there is a God to be uninteresting and an unnecessary distraction. I'm all for humans advancing or understanding the universe, but I don't find any value in a question, the God question, for which there is ultimately no answer. That's kind of the point of your book, right?
But these are the best questions, Glade.
<That's true.
laughs> The ones to which there are ultimately no answers. They're what keep your mind alive. They're what keep you thinking, keep you on your toes. I mean, like I say, you know, you can be an intellectual couch potato and sort of make up your mind and have everything neat and squared away. Or you can just... I admit I'm an incredibly messy thinker. I sort of go this way and I go that way, and that's what exploration is. It's why many friends hate to go hiking with me, by the way, because, you know, they'll say, okay, the trail's this way and I'm veering off another way altogether. They say, where are you going? I'll say, but it looks interesting this way. And they say, but you'll get lost. And I say, that's fine. You know, I'll find my way again one way or the other, right? For some people, I really am a nightmare to go hiking with. It's just the adventure of being alive, of this mystery of existence, because we don't understand it, right? This mystery of consciousness, right? For everything that we now know in neurobiology and neuropsychiatry and so on, we know how, you know, we know the physical correlates of thought, but we have no idea. Nobody does, not scientists and not philosophers, what consciousness is. You know, it's like that question that one wonderful philosopher from New York University asked, Thomas Nagel. He said, what's it like to be a bat?
Yeah.
Right? Not the kind that you hit balls with, but the kind that flies, zooms around and so on. So we know... I love it. I mean, I love any philosopher who's even capable of asking a question like this. What's it like to be a bat? Because we know how bats work. We know how they navigate. We know how they use radar. We know what they eat. We know their bone structure and their wing structure and so on. But we have no idea what the experience of being a bat is like. Is there a consciousness to a bat? We have no idea what our own consciousness is. Either in that sense, and in the sense of physical existence, it's a marvel. And I think the only thing to do is to revel in it, keep asking questions, to try and figure it out. But I hope we never do. I really hope we never do, because once there's answers to everything, it's almost like, what's the point of being alive? How disappointing it would be, how dull it would be to have the answers to everything. It's like, you know, sometimes you're at a dinner table and a really interesting question comes up, right? And nobody knows the answer. This one's got one idea and this one's got another idea, for instance. And then somebody there will whip out his phone, and it's almost always a he, and look it up, right, on Wikipedia or on Google or something, and come up with the answer. And then there's this sort of Paul comes over the conversation. Oh my God, you know, there's the answer. You know, and it could be something as trivial as what movie it was, or it could be something, you know, much bigger, like what's the size of, you know, the Milky Way. But faced with the answer, it's just, okay, where's the fun in that?
Yeah. Which gets us to the love of mystery, which you write about. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk about when we get back from a break. Leslie Hazelton is with us. Her book is Agnostic, A Spirited Manifesto. 801-585-WEST, the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Ladies, you're welcome to write in, too. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Leslie Hazelton, writer and psychologist. Her new book is Agnostic, A Spirited Manifesto. I want to have you read a section from the book. This is a story you tell of climbing Mount Sinai. It's such a such an image. Would you set this up for us? You're climbing and you have this experience that I want you to read about, and then I want to talk about it. Because there's this question, can a firmly secular person such as yourself have a religious experience? So set this up for us. You're up there and you've come upon this narrow, dark kind of section.
Yeah. I decided, and this also, you know, is totally paradoxical. I decided I wanted to know what it was like to spend the night on top of a sacred mountain,
yeah,
alone, right? So I was climbing up alone. I went up the back way. You know, there's a regular way with these steep, bouldered steps and so on. But I went up the back way so as nobody would try to stop me. And it was hot, of course, and I was tired, and it's really, really rough red granite. It's very hard to climb on. And finally, about two-thirds of the way up, I come across this, I enter this sort of narrow defile, this very, and it was very dark. It was in the shade, which was wonderful, you know, for a moment. But it was only when I got into the defile that I realized, you know, that it was really, really narrow and deep. So I'm reading here from the book. Its darkness felt ominous, as though this were not merely forbidding, but forbidden territory. I took a few tentative steps forward, fighting panic as the rock walls appeared to close in on me, and the thought flashed through my head that I'd be trapped here, that the stone would never let me out. And then I found myself moving into something ineffably strange and uncannily beautiful, a deep rose-coloured light that seemed to come from everywhere and nowhere. The air itself was suffused with this light, glowing with it, and as I breathed in, it seemed to suffuse me too. I felt like I was floating, buoyed by the light, cradled and gentled by it. And it was as though the mountain was welcoming me, taking me into itself. And even as some part of me was aware that this was an absurd notion, it was almost palpable nonetheless. It lasted perhaps a minute or two, no more. At the far end of the defile, the steep rock walls fell away and the light subsided, mellowing into the old master colours of sunset, as I found myself looking over the hollow hidden at the heart of the mountain, and just below me, the final reach of steep, bouldered steps up to the peak. I remember thinking that I should really turn back and figure out what had caused that extraordinary light, and yet I didn't turn back. Some part of me was afraid that if I did, the light wouldn't be there anymore. Another part, that I'd discover the cause and thus explain the light away. I didn't turn back because I didn't want reason or causality. I opted instead for mystery. And I sat down and stayed there a while, reveling in what felt like my own magic mountain, and then went on up to the peak and the sunset spreading gold, then red, and then purple over the mountains, and finally the ethereal silver of moonlight. Hmm. And the thing is here, it's
you didn't want to go back.
You know,
something would have... Right. If you went back, something could have... Oh, it's the time of day, or there happens to be some sort of reflection that gives it that kind of light. But you were just like, no, I'm just going to let it be, right?
Yeah, or refraction. I mean... Yeah. Now, if you were religious, you could say that I saw the light.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, in a very literal sense, I did see light, not the light. Again, that definite article sort of, you know, messing things up, over-determining the matter. But I was certainly aware that you know, this was quite perfect. I mean, it was exactly the sort of thing that should happen on a holy mountain. You know, I'd been prepped for mystery by all the stories I'd heard about Mount Sinai and everything that had happened on Mount Sinai. So I sort of went with the vision of the moment and the place. And my point is that this was a choice, right? It was a conscious choice. And after what I said about, you know, science and scientists and so on, let me quote a romantic poet and accuse me, if you like, of being a romantic, John Keats,
yeah,
who described breaking free of, you know, definitive systems of thought and perception as negative capability. I'm not quite sure why he called it negative, but I think it is capability. And he said, this is the capacity to be, and I quote, in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. And I love that word irritable there. It really, really works for me. So the issue isn't really what happened to me on Mount Sinai, but how I think about what happened. I mean, I could always, you know, give in to that relentless need to categorize and file it neatly under the appropriate tag. You know, I could tell it if I wanted to be really pompous as a spiritual or a mystical experience. Mm-hmm. You know, that would be pretty self-aggrandizing. Or I could say that, you know, it was physiology and I was mildly, you know, dehydrated because I hadn't taken enough water with me. And that's really dumb in the desert. And I could point to physics, you know, a matter of refraction, you know, the light of the lowering sun sort of angled just so. Or I could say that I was in an altered state of consciousness caused by both altitude and weariness. But, you know, it all seems disappointingly down to earth for such a heady state of mind. And then, you know, my question is, well, how down to earth do you really want to be when you're up on top of a mountain? So it's just enjoy the moment, basically. And take it for what it, you know, take it for what, not for what it is, because there is no it is. It doesn't have an essential quality. It's always what we make of it. It's always what we put into it, what we project onto it. And if you're aware of that, there's poetry and science in it. There's knowledge in it. There's experience in it. There's enjoyment in it. Let's not forget enjoyment. Zest, right? Yes, you can explain everything away and then, okay, it's kind of disappointing. Or you can just say, wow, that was a magical moment.
So
may we have many more of them.
It's a comment from Brian, who is calling from South Jordan. And Brian's comment is, let me just sort of speak for you if I can, Brian. Used to be an atheist or slash agnostic, although I don't probably imagine he thinks they're both the same thing. But he says, now I'm religious. He says, belief in God doesn't necessarily make life easier or solve all of your problems. And I think his point is that for some religious people, they're not looking to God to provide ready answers, but to challenge their existence, challenge their idea. What do you make of that?
Then this is thank you so much for bringing that up, because the people I know of deepest religious faith are not certain of anything at all. They don't believe they found the answer. They don't believe they know, quote-unquote, the truth. They are beset by doubt. They live with doubt, and the doubt is an essential part of their faith. Basically, doubt is what creates faith. Faith sort of leads on from doubt. When you believe something, and it's more honest, because, you know, let's think about what we talk about when we say that someone believes something. When you say you believe something, you are implicitly saying that it may not be believable. You don't know it for sure, because there is no knowing for sure. You believe it to be so. You trust it to be so. You have faith that it be so. So when we conflate belief with faith, we're basically demeaning faith, you know, claiming that it's certainty. It isn't. And I think, as I say, the people of deepest faith that I know, religious faith, basically love this book and love everything I say about, you know, the agnostic stance and the spiritedness of it, because it's where they are too.
Yeah.
So again, it's defying categories. You don't have to define yourself as atheist or as agnostic or as a believer or as religious and so on. I mean, the religion is basically a huge umbrella term which has tried to claim so much of human experience, but we don't have to use that umbrella. We can strike out for ourselves. Yeah. It's okay.
I want to ask you about one of the things you write about is there's this idea, religion, you say, is at its best when it's dealing with death, because it provides comfort for people who might be afraid of death or don't know what happens after we die. But really, you kind of question this idea that, in fact, we are all afraid of death and that we're just these selfish humans who want immortality. Would you talk about that part, that idea, this assumption that we all fear death? Because you take that on in the book.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a con that's been played on us by, you know, a religious dogma, not by religion itself. There is no such thing as religion itself, but by religious dogma, sort of to keep people in line, you know, sort of behave in this life because, you know, we've got this carrot or the stick of the afterlife. Right? I mean, most people know, you know, the carrot doesn't really work. I mean, you know, if you're really delusional, you might imagine that you're a saint and you're going to go to heaven. But most of us know, okay. So the idea is sort of to keep people quaking and obedient for fear of what might happen in a hypothetical next life. Hell, brimstone, you know, hellfire and so on. And what I'm advocating is that we live and appreciate the life we have instead of another life that may or may not exist on a different level. And this is what we talk about. When we talk about the soul, we're imagining that it's a thing, right? An entity, right, that will live on after the body dies. Well, what a terrible way of actually living this life. Right? Like the body doesn't matter. Only the soul matters and so on. Just think, instead of living with soul, soul is sort of a way of being in and with the world. I find it far more, you know, attractive, right? Far more exciting. Immortality. I mean, I know that there's all these Silicon Valley billionaires now trying to figure out life extension and sort of, you know, dreams of doubling your lifespan and so on. And I'm thinking, why? Right? It is a span. It is an arc. If you could live forever, how boring life would be, you know. There's no narrative left to it. There's no arc left to it. There's just one thing after another to infinity. And I'm thinking that's my idea of hell.
Right. Let me ask you one more question. We have about a minute left, so maybe it's not fair to try to put this into a minute. But you say in the book, you know, that we should just stop trying to nail down the transcendent. And what would that be like? You know, stop trying to claim we know what God is thinking, or try to pretend like we're familiar with God or lay claim to God. Could we even do that, do you think? If we have all these almost biological impulses to find meaning, to be certain, do we even have it in us as a species to move beyond something more sophisticated?
I'm not so sure they're biological. You know, this term hardwired, right? We're machines with wires in us and so on and so on.
Right.
And let's just throw out the wires and enjoy being human.
Well put. Leslie Hazelton, her book is Agnostic, A Spirited Manifesto, joined us today from Seattle. Leslie, good to talk to you again. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Doug. Good to talk to you. And thanks, everybody who called in.
Radio West, production of KUER News. Our congratulations to our intern, Sophie Sirois, who just graduated from the University of Utah today. It's her last day. So a special thanks from all of us for her good work over the last semester. Technical direction today from Tim Slover. Video West, produced by Josh Weathers. Radio West, produced by Benjamin Bombard, Annie Lane Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.